Good morning. I'm Peter Waltz, and I'm a tree person. Or perhaps I should say, good morning, my fellow multicellular organisms. How many cells, you ask? For an average human, about 3.27 times 10 to the 13th cells. Both we and trees are multicellular organisms, unable to exist without a large number of cells acting together. Now think about it. How many people here are involved in life science or have an interest in life science? I'm going to show a hand. My introduction to trees began early with my dad, who taught me and my brother to identify trees in the woods. My interest grew steadily to the point that I felt compelled to know more and more about all tree species and how they function. Here are a few details I've learned over the years. Trees are an evolutionary success story in the plant world, being the largest of land plants. Early plants were apparently small and stemless like mosses. Plants evolved to have a stem, but a transitory stem, whose lifetime ended when its leaves' lifetime ended. And remember that leaves are a wear part with a finite lifetime. Another evolutionary advance was a persistent above-ground stem with resting buds. And a further advance was a complete ring of cambium. When the ring of cambium is combined with branching and buds and a persistent above-ground stem, that structures a tree. The cambium over time grows a lignified stem that we call wood. The core of older wood allows the stem to enlarge in a series of stages of growth, laying new cells on top of old cells, resulting in an ever larger, taller structure. I think for most of us, it is this large branch structure, coupled with a lifespan easily longer than our own, that inspires admiration. Well, it is for me anyway. I continue to study some detailed aspect of the biology of plants on an almost daily basis. That's one side of the brain working. On the other side of the brain, I love trees in an emotional and personal way that has no basis in science. I bow in the presence of large trees. When you hug a tree, you can see the staging of branches and trunk from a very different perspective, so I hug often. Trees are an elegant expression of a creative force, and I thank the creative force that made a tree. Even if I knew everything scientific there is to know about a tree, it would be no less beautiful. When someone from the Exeter Conservation Commission asked me if I would be interested in being involved in a fifth grade tree program, I said, yes, it just felt right. I've been involved in that fifth grade program at the Lincoln Street School ever since. That was about 1990. And this week is going to be on Wednesday, if anyone wants to come. As part of the program, all students get a tree seedling of their own at the end of the day. Perhaps the most important part of the talk is the enthusiasm I'm usually able to project. In 45 minutes of rambling, I attempt to show that a study of trees is much more than what you can get in a single book or on a single website. I show a collection of 20 oak herbarium sheets showing leaves and twigs. I talk about the possibility of learning new things by reading after you have graduated. That's how I learned what I know about trees. I have one favorite exhibit of a majestic Magnolia macrophylla leaf, a single leaf 40 inches long by 20 inches wide, grown right here in Exeter. Let the leaf speak for itself. I talk about the lifetime of trees, normal causes of tree death, how trees repair damage, and what they, as tree stewards, might be able to do to help a tree live longer if it is damaged. I think all of this information is new to them. I confirm that oaks and magnolias are my favorite trees. And at the end of the 45 minutes, I hope they can see not only am I really, really interested in trees, but maybe it's okay to be really, really interested in something personal to oneself, almost certainly the most important takeaway. What makes talking about trees so easy is the fact I've been fascinated by plants ever since I was about 5 years old, starting with beans in a jar. This shifted over time to veggies, flowers, and trees. I have a collection of seed-grown trees around my house. I like to visit arboreta and native woodlands in the U.S. and other countries to see how the native flora works, the upper story, lower story, ground plants. This is a game without end, good for a lifetime.
One of these folk stories that has, well, as many different versions as there are folk. So you may know a version of this story. You can tell me your version on the way out by the door where I hear all the gems. This one's about old Joe, who lived out in the countryside, and he had one good neighbor. They'd been friends all their lives. And both of them had lost their spouses, and their children were grown and off in the world, and they really just had their farms and each other. Until just recently, when this stray calf came wandering in, and they couldn't decide who it belonged to. And somehow, they each decided that it was their calf and that the other one shouldn't have it. And they got to arguing about the calf, and Joe's neighbor decided that he ought to have the calf, but Joe said, no, the calf clearly belongs to me because it looks like my cow. Well, one of the things they had in common, of course, is they were a little stubborn. But ever since they'd argued about this calf, they hadn't spoken. It'd been a couple of weeks now. Joe was sitting in his kitchen, drinking coffee, looking out the window, when there was a knock on the door. It was an itinerant worker, and he had a work bag with him, and he said, well, he was a carpenter, and he was looking for some work, and old Joe thought, carpenter, I have some work for you. Yeah, you could help me with something. So he brought him into the kitchen, and they stood and looked out the window together, and the old Joe said to the young carpenter, that's my neighbor. We had this little thing about the calf, and then he went up on the hill with his plow and changed the way the spring comes down, and now there's a stream between our properties where there never has been before. I don't want to look at him anymore. Can you build a fence so I can't see his house anymore? The carpenter said, well, I could. I could do that. So they went out to the barn and they looked at the lumber that old Joe had there, and the carpenter said, yeah, this would get me started, but I would need more wood if you really want to fence the whole way. So the carpenter got to work and old Joe went into town in his truck to get some more wood. And after a while, old Joe came back up his road and he could see that the carpenter had been in work. That he had built something that was sturdy and strong, and it was a bridge that went over that little stream. It had nice handrails. It was sturdy. And old Joe pulled up in his truck, and he's getting out, about to talk to the carpenter, and he saw that his neighbor was coming across the bridge with his hand held out. So old Joe had to go over to the bridge. And his neighbor said, you are a fine man. I couldn't have done what you've done. I'm so glad that we can be friends and neighbors again. How can I ever thank you? And then he just embraced old Joe, and the music swelled. Well, then Joe said, "Oh, well, all right, the calf is yours. I'd like to be friends, too." So they stood there on the bridge and talked for a minute. And then they noticed that the carpenter was packing up his tool bag and starting to walk away. And old Joe said, "You know, I actually have quite a bit of work around the place. If you can stick around, I'd have you do it." And the carpenter said, "Oh, you know, I think I have work to do elsewhere." Walked off down the road. Fair amount of talk these days about building walls. And you can kind of see how people get there. You get upset about something and you can't figure out what to do, and so you build a wall. And the truth is, we all do it, just not quite that grandly. We find ways to just not interact with the thing that we disagree with or find difficult or aren't sure about or are just mad about. So one of the things that I have decided recently is that I'm going to remove a couple of phrases from my vocabulary. And then when I stop saying them out loud, perhaps I'll stop thinking them. There can be a lag time between those two. But I'm going to try no longer to say, "I'm offended by that," or "that's offensive." Because I think that that is actually a way of building a wall. It shuts down the possibility of exchange with whoever is in that moment. Because once you get to that moment, everyone is completely defensive, and it's not a good moment for conversation. I think it's really, emotionally, it's a way of saying, "That's bad, and I'm better than you, and I won't talk about it." And now occasionally there is some exchange of words after the phrase "I'm offended" gets said, but there's rarely contact or conversation. And I think the world that we're in is demanding that we find ways to make contact with each other. But I also want to be very clear that I am not suggesting that when people say or do things that one would normally find offensive, well, that I'm not planning to just let it slide or ignore it or just pretend that everything's okay, because that's not a good option either. That's just turning around instead of building a wall. So I'm going to try to think of some other responses that have the intention of making contact rather than the intention of proving myself right and someone else wrong, even if they might be. Because what it looks like in the world is that we're pretty dug in on who's right and who's wrong, and it's not getting us anywhere. We're almost all on the lookout for things to react to, things that aren't right. The news, that's all the news is. And so we get that all the time, and so our minds are full of that too. So what I'm trying to do by not being offended by things anymore is I'm trying to turn my mind from what is right and what is wrong to having a constant practice of remembering that everyone is trying to figure it out and remembering their humanity. I'm pretty sure that's the only way out of the mess that we're in. And you can cite many of the social change movements that have worked toward this idea, and it's a hard one to work on. Martin Luther King and Gandhi both have some amazing words, which maybe one of you will write on a sticky note, put up in the other room, about how reconciling with each other is the only way that things change. But King was someone who worked on making sure that the laws of society made sure that people had to act a certain way. He didn't say everyone had to think alike and that everyone had to agree with what he thought, but that we had to act well toward each other. But what motivated him was a sense of deep love, of the possibility that we were all indeed connected. And then David Brooks in the New York Times wrote an op-ed piece this week. Did any of you read that? It's one of those moments when someone sent me the link to it, and I thought, oh, can I read that instead of the sermon that I've written? Because that's pretty much it. I think we can put the link up on the website so that if you haven't read it, you can go and read it. This is what he calls for. He calls for making contact across class lines, across many of the societal divisions that we have come to accept as, well, that's just the way it has to be. He doesn't propose any grand plan, and I have already proposed to you the grandest plan that I have so far, which is that we begin to turn our minds away from who's wrong and who's right and toward making contact. I was on a panel recently with a political science professor from UNH, and we were talking about how do you create change, particularly when it comes to matters of climate change. How do you get people to live differently? And he observed, as many people have observed about many kinds of changes, that the information is not sufficient. If information was all we needed, all manner of problems would have been taken care of by now because we've got the information and it's pretty well distributed, really. And that's not working. So there has to be something else. So he said it looks like relationships, actual connections, are the key. And the thing that he said that was really useful to me was that each of us travels in a lot of different circles. And we tend to forget that that's true of all of us. When we're here, we're Unitarian Universalists, and we're in this circle. But each of you overlaps with a whole bunch of different circles of people. And you might, in fact, be a little bit surprised by the other circles that the people in your row or column overlap with. And if you got to hear all of the places we overlap and the things that we're connected to, we might be surprised by the relationships that are out there and available to us for real contact. I can spend all week just in this circle and forget how we're connected much more broadly. You're connected to school groups and active retirement groups and Civil War reenactment groups and groups of people who have boats and veterans, people who have bicycles, people who homeschool. There are all kinds of things connected here. So I think the first step, and I think this is a long game, and I think that the spiritual life, the religious life, is a long game. I think the first step is for Unitarian Universalists to listen, to very intentionally listen, to listen past that first thing that I think, wow, that's offensive, to keep listening past that. David Brooks and a number of other social and political observers have described it well, that some of the things that are being said and done in our culture right now that are the most disturbing to me are really a sign of people who feel disregarded and discarded. That the places that we're most reactive right now are among the people all over the spectrum who feel like they've been pushed aside as not important. And we can listen more deeply into that reality. Listen past the positions that people take. Listen past the bluster and the anger. And hear that human need to be not only seen, but seen as fully human. And I think there, somewhere in that moment, is where we begin to find and create a new way to build a society. And this listening might take a variety of forms. It might mean asking people that you don't normally have conversation with an open-ended question, like, what's your work like these days? Ask someone who you don't normally have this kind of conversation with, how's your family doing? Not political questions and not solutions questions, but questions that invite an open sharing of experience and thinking. Some folks in our congregation are about to get trained in how to ask open-ended questions. If you were here when Christopher preached a few weeks ago, he talked a little bit about the Clearness Committee, which is a process of asking, learning to ask really open-ended questions, which are hard to do. So when they get that figured out, we'll have them come and talk to us about asking open-ended questions, because they are a way to find each other's humanity. But we can start experimenting now. Ask your neighbor, especially if there's a neighbor who you're not always talking with, the clerk at the grocery store, your car mechanic, your great uncle, what's the hardest thing in your life these days? Or what's changed in your life or your work? And then just listen to that experience. And there isn't a concrete result right away. It's just making contact, particularly with someone who you don't usually have that level of contact with. And when your neighbor is just plain wrong, maybe don't go directly at it. Don't try to fix the thing that's wrong right away. Ask about their life, their family. Ask about their earliest memories of May. Find the place in the circle where you do overlap. And then let that sink in before we take on the place where they're wrong. As David Brooks says, we have forgotten that we are all in this together. Let us remind ourselves by listening. I offered you the words of Mr. Rogers earlier. He is one of those spiritual teachers for people in my generation. He was a minister and a very religious man and a very public man, and he lived his religious life very publicly. And yet you could have watched all of those shows with the neighborhood of make-believe and maybe never known that about him, because he just embodied it. He also said this, "If you could only sense how important you are to the lives of those you meet, how important you can be to the people you may never dream of. There is something of yourself that you leave at every meeting with another person."